From the Firebird Radio Studio, it's the Authors on Fire podcast with nationally syndicated radio host and producer, Pat Rulo.
Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network, home of the International Firebird Book Awards, the Positive Change Podcast Awards Hall of Fame, Book Song, where we create a unique song to complement your book, and our newest Book Blessings, a personalized way to set intentions for your book or your books. This is the Authors on Fire podcast, and I am Pat Rulo. Today, I have a recent Firebird Book Award winner to share with you. She is Marie Lisette Reimer, and the winning book is titled Back from Suicide, Before and After the Essential Patrick. Marie received a BA and MA in secondary education at the University of Connecticut and was a publicist in the Connecticut legislature and an award-winning English teacher at Rectory School in Pomfret, Connecticut. The joy of three children and country living was shattered by the suicide of her youngest son, Patrick Wood, in 2006. And today we explore the story behind Back from Suicide, a mother's journey to understand her son Patrick's life, his struggles with depression, and the tragic choice he made. Through her research and reflections, I'm sure we will gain insight into the nature of mental illness, the pressures facing young LGBTQ people, and the limits of love in the face of disease. So this is a conversation about grief, understanding, and hope. Welcome to the Authors on Fire podcast, Marie.
Thank you. That's a lovely introduction. I really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, I so appreciate that you dared to write this book. I just can't imagine how emotional this was, but probably how essential. But before we get into it, I was thrilled to share with you that your book won in the Firebird Book Awards.
I was just very honored. I really, really appreciated it. Just, I'm a first-time author, and it was just wonderful verification that what I was feeling, you know, kind of deep emotions, but I knew that would not be enough for readers. And so you gave me verification that it actually made sense to someone else.
Oh, thank you. You know, I think anytime you put your heart and soul and every inch of your fiber into whatever you create, whether it's book or art, it has to be appreciated. I don't know how you could put all of that in there and not have somebody else recognize that, no?
Well, I had read a lot of suicide memoirs, and I mean, they were wonderful at talking about what happened, mm-hmm. how it happened, but not so much about why it happened. And in my case, I knew that information was out there. I also knew I was very ignorant about that information. I was ignorant about Pat's depression. I didn't understand that it's a serious medical issue, and if it's not treated, it can result in suicide. And in Pat's case, in my mind, he was the least likely person to commit suicide. He was, the top scholar in his middle school. He won a full scholarship to Pomfret School. He achieved perfect SAT scores. He went to Stanford. He graduated as valedictorian from his high school. He went to Stanford on another scholarship, and he graduated with honors. And I thought all of that were signs of health, mm-hmm. but I didn't understand that depression canceled all that in his mind, and he just didn't see it that way. And I just could not reconcile all that achievement, all that. He was happy for most of his life. All the humor, all the sarcasm, all the great laughs, all the kindness, the generosity, the humbleness that he had about being as bright as he was. And I just didn't realize that untreated depression can just wipe out an entire life of constant success.
For you not to have recognized that was very easy. You wouldn't expect that such a presentation, I guess, that he gave the world. was hiding that in the background. I don't even know how one would go about recognizing. And so I think what you're doing in this book is that you're emphasizing not just the story, but that suicide is driven by disease rather than circumstance. Yeah. So help explain what that means for families and friends who try to understand or prevent it.
Well, I tried to emphasize that suicide is a disease because my eyes were opened to that by a book I stumbled on when my family and I were looking for a gravestone for Patrick. So we were on the most dreaded trip of our lives. And then came this sudden epiphany with a book called Against Suicide by Peter Kramer, who explains how depression works in the brain to lay people like me, to naive mothers like me who really didn't understand that suicide changes the structure of your brain. It ruins the connections in your brain. He talks about something that he calls the stuck switch problem, which is when you're feeling stress, a short amount of it is great. You know, you get tremendous energy and, you know, you react to the danger or the threat that you see in the moment. But when you can't turn that stress off, you are feeling anxiety. You are having panic attacks. You are disappointed more than people without depression. That's what ruins the connections in your brain. It hurts the neuronal structures in your brain. And if it continues, then permanent damage is done and your brain cannot regenerate healthy cells. So I realized there was so much beyond what I knew, what I saw. Even though Patrick was hospitalized at Stanford about a year before he died, we had these wonderful conversations about my mother's alcoholism, her suicide, him coming out to me, me just feeling so grateful that we could have these deep conversations. And I took those as signs of health. Mm-hmm. And I just had no idea that depression was operating under the surface, inside, and attacking the very part of him that was making decisions, including the decision of whether or not to kill himself. He was not dealing with a fully functioning organ, and his brain was giving him, as one doctor put it, giving him misinformation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he starts to put some of the pieces together. Now, I wonder how his perfectionism, his identity struggles, you mentioned that he came out to you, and genetic history, you just mentioned that you had family members with alcohol addiction, mm-hmm. and suicide. So, you know, we were combining perfectionism, identity struggles, genetic history, and now it's interacting with depression to create what mm-hmm. you describe as an unstoppable fire.
Yes, you're right. Yes. I learned more since I wrote the book, which was the amount of suicide that Pat had on both sides of his family. My mother killed herself with drinking and pills, and my husband, Patrick's father, also he had a family member, actually several family members, who killed themselves. Patrick's grandfather, my husband's father, killed himself along with a brother and a sister and a nephew. So as one member of the family put it to me when I launched the book about a year ago, she said, some families get diabetes, we got suicide. And I thought she summed it up perfectly. So yes, it was a greater factor than I realized in Patrick's case. And beyond that, the perfectionism, I did worry about that. But at the same time, it was producing all of these magnificent accomplishments. I mean, he was a classic professional pianist. He won many piano competitions. He achieved perfect SAT scores. I just did not see the downside of that. I didn't understand that really perfection is impossible. And that combined with depression, that would set him up for disappointment. And what I learned about depression is that people who are depressed cannot handle disappointment. They do not respond like others without clinical depression who can, yes, we're momentarily or for a while, we're severely sad. However, we can climb out of it. What I had to learn about Patrick is that he went lower, way lower. And I know now that it was probably because his brain was probably not fully functioning because of the assault of depression on his brain. Mm-hmm. It changes the structure of his brain. And I learned more about that when I was giving a talk recently, and I wrote an op-ed in the Hartford Courant where I really wanted to understand what the proof was about changing the structure of the brain. And the proof was in recent studies that showed that brains of people who die by suicide are different. For example, the hippocampus is smaller in people who die by suicide. The hippocampus is responsible for memory and learning. And then parts of the prefrontal cortex are also smaller in people who die by suicide. And those parts are responsible for emotion regulation and impulse control. Serotonin levels are lower in people who die by suicide. And what it taught me is that while I thought that depression was a thinking disease, yes, it is, but it also goes beyond that. It goes beyond the ostensible reasons for suicide. For example, in Pat's case, being rejected by a boy he wanted to be with in Berlin, where he was working, or in other cases, a divorce or financial problems. Yes, those are the external reasons, but to me, they just weren't enough. It just did not explain suicide. So I had to learn the internal factors of suicide. I had to learn that suicide is not logical. It is biological. And when your loved one starts saying things that don't make sense, like in Pat's case, I had thoughts of suicide, but then in the next minute, but don't worry, I'm not going to do anything. Those thoughts could be from changes in the brain, which prove that suicide is a medical issue. You cannot just talk someone out of a disease. It needs professional medical help. In Pat's case, both therapy and medication worked well, but when he was in Berlin, he did not want to see a psychologist in Berlin. And I did not understand at the time that it was not enough for me to suggest that. One of the main parts of suicide prevention is that you have to take action with that person, meaning I should have gotten on a plane and gone over there to help him get help.
That's putting a lot on you, my friend. How old was he, Marie?
He was 23.
Okay.
Yeah, he was 23 years old.
You were talking about the prefrontal cortex being smaller. I'm wondering, when children are young or young adults, that section of the brain is not even fully formed as well. I wonder if that plays a role. Mm-hmm. You talked about genetics. And then, you know, we also have the fact that other family members had experienced this themselves, that maybe it somehow normalized it. I wonder what all these different gray areas, did they all come into play at once? Was it one thing? Was it two? You know, I don't even know how you come to understand that.
I agree. Yeah, I had no clue that what I thought was a wonderful, deep conversation about my mother's own suicide with Pat when he was in Stanford Hospital. I thought that would help him understand that this is a danger, that it's in the family. I mean, I really wasn't smart enough to know about genetics at that point. But then, as you mentioned, while I was in therapy, that's exactly what my therapist said, which was that it could have been a model for him. It could have been
a way out.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That I might have been suggesting that, oh, right, this is what we do. And it was how it could have been interpreted that way, I could not imagine at the time. But I do remember conversations with Patrick that worried me. And yet I just did not understand how to put them together. One factor was for example, they say in suicide prevention that you know when you're worried about someone alluding to taking their own lives, you really have to get on their level and talk about it. And in Patrick's case, when he was graduating, we were helping him move out of his dorm room at Stanford, and I said, "Do you think Berlin will be good for you socially?" And he turned away from his computer and looked at me and he said, "Yeah." He said, I'm giving myself a year." And at the time I was hurt. I knew he meant something, but I didn't really know what. He was ambivalent enough at that point that he wasn't really admitting anything. But sure enough, within that year, he had passed away. And now I know that what he was thinking was that he had a timeline. He was giving himself a deadline for when he was going to do it if he did not get a relationship that he wanted in Berlin. And the other time that was probably more serious was the last visit. He came home for Christmas, his last Christmas. We had a conversation about a book he was reading, a book I had bought him actually, called The Sorrows of Young Werther, which I didn't realize was banned in Germany because it had resulted in copycat suicides in Germany. And we were just talking about the plot of the book, which is that this young man, Werther, falls in love with Lottie. She's married. And so Werther cannot accept that. And he shoots himself and has a terrible drawn out death, you know, buried immediately. Lottie never comes to say goodbye. It's a real heartbreaking story. And at the time I said, you know, to Patrick, death scares me. And Patrick said, it would be so easy. And he said it just like that. He drew out the word so, and I thought, I was scared. But then a minute later, we were speaking normally, and I was thinking to myself, okay. And I was latching on to these good moments, mm-hmm. that it was just a total oversimplification on my part. I just really did not understand that depressed people sink lower faster than we do, and when they come out of it, it does not mean that it's not going to happen again.
Wow. Sounds like he really was struggling with identity and acceptance and, finding that person, huh?
The identity part, I thought he was okay with it. He told me he was okay with it. And I thought, I can't, you know, he was in a great gay community. Berlin is fascinating to me. I mean, within really a few decades, it's gone from the most fascist city to the most tolerant city. It was glorious to be there, unfortunately, after he died, but still to meet all of his friends, to go to his gay clubs, to be welcome, to to walk in the gay pride parade, to have kids come up to me and give me a hug because, you know, they knew I was there because Patrick had died. It was in the most welcoming community he could have been anywhere in the world. And I loved getting to know it. And yet depression overcame that. It just canceled everything he had to live for, which was way more than most people.
You wrote how he actually accomplished this. Seems like it was such a situation that he would have had time to back out of it.
Yeah, you're right. That's such a good point. I had a lot to learn about that method.
Maybe share it with us if you would.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, Pat died of carbon monoxide poisoning, and he did it by charcoal burning, which is, I understand, a common method in Japan. In this country, the most common method is with firearms. Mm-hmm. In China, it used to be pesticides because they were pretty easy to get. Not so much anymore. And, you know, as one researcher put it, people have to get rid of their fear of death. And I realized that when Pat said it would be so easy. By then, that's what he was saying.
Yeah, he thought it out.
He had thought it out, and he had gotten rid of his fear of death. Mm-hmm. And the next thing is that they have to get rid of the fear of pain. And Pat chose a method that he knew. It doesn't always for everybody. So I am not saying that at all. Right. And you know, for example, I don't really know if he didn't feel any pain. There are stories from doctors that it doesn't always go as planned when you burn charcoal in an airtight room, as Patrick did. You have to have the concentration right. You have to be conked out. It's very tricky. It takes a lot of planning, and I cannot imagine that he would have gone through it. There can be a feeling of suffocation. It's horrible. Yeah. Just absolutely horrible. I can't imagine anybody go through this. Not anybody. But anyway, the thing that my therapist told me about that method is that people who use that method are determined, and they tunnel vision. And this is pretty common knowledge nowadays. I've heard some, you know, interesting webinars from suicide experts who say that, you know, when suicidal people have made up their mind, their brains tunnel vision on that end result. And all the alternatives, all the things he could have done, all the, you know, using my charge card to get on a plane and fly home or fly back to Stanford, all that is out of view. It is not accessible. So what she was trying to do, my therapist was, just convince me that he was in a zone that was out of reach. Mm-hmm. And in that zone, she said, he was probably not feeling pain. He was probably feeling relief that the end was near. Mm-hmm. And take it for what you will, but it's complicated, and it's can be painful. People who survive that method are damaged for life.
Mm-hmm. Wow. He was obviously intelligent enough and very focused on this outcome. I mean, this was like a goal. I mean, it was something that he wanted to accomplish, and he did it well. So maybe during that whole process, he was at peace with himself. I mean, we can't understand that. But as you say, he might have been in such a zone that he was just solely focused on accomplishing this way. I don't know. There's really no answer to it, but you try to sit back and kind of armchair quarterback this whole thing and figure out what. I don't know if you ever thought that you had a glimpse of what he might have been thinking in his final moments. And if you did, how did exploring that perspective help you? And how did it affect the narrative of this book?
That's a great question. The more I learned about that process, it really did. It was terrible. It was gruesome. It was hard to go there.
Yeah.
But the reason that it helped me is because it made me realize he was the one who did this. Mm-hmm. I was having trouble separating myself.
Yeah, trying to be a part of it when really you were not part of this.
Exactly. I was having trouble separating it with the questions. Is it my fault? Is it because I didn't do enough? Is it his fault? Did he have will enough to do this? Obviously he did. He could think clearly enough to complete a very complicated process. But when I learned about how complicated that process is, the more I learned about it, the more I realized he planned this from the beginning. When I asked him if he wanted therapy, if he wanted a psychologist in Berlin, and he said no, I realized then that it was because he already had this plan. And when I studied how people actually do this, you know, just terrible stories, people meeting in cars in Japan and killing themselves together. It's just heartbreaking. And, but when I realized how much planning went into it, how he had to get an apartment to be, you know, to live by himself so that he could decide when and where he wanted to do it, how you have to get the charcoal burning a certain length of time so you can get the right concentration. I mean, all of this was him. It wasn't me.
Right.
And that's how it helped me. I realized he just wasn't going to tell me everything. We had these great, long, open conversations, non-judgmental, by the way. He was just such a brilliant person. Everything he did was saintly to me. So, yeah, I guess the upshot is, yeah, I was grieving, but that just wasn't enough. I needed knowledge. And that knowledge helped me learn how to grieve, to learn what was his part, what was my part. Yeah, I mean, I could have done more, but I didn't kill him. No. It wasn't me. And that's what I came away with.
Good. I hope that you can rest in that and be in peace with that. Grief is such a difficult thing, regardless of how any loved one passes on. With this in particular, looking back, what advice would you give to someone struggling who is navigating grief after a loved one dies by suicide?
Therapy is huge. You need to be able to park it on someone else's shoulders. It didn't work for everybody in our family. It didn't work for my husband as much. He had his own way, and that's fine. That was okay. It worked well for Pat's twin sister, Libby, who it was really just a godsend to her and to me, because we learned so much about what people go through to get to the point of wanting to kill themselves. And that's what I desperately needed. I needed to learn what suicide was, how people got there, and most importantly, in Pat's case, I learned how much of an important part being gay fed into depression and how much that contributed to suicide. You know, gay kids, are way more vulnerable than straight kids to suicide. In 2020, they were four times as likely to attempt suicide. And attempting suicide is the number one indicator of a completed suicide. So I had no idea about that. I thought, okay, he wanted to go to Stanford. He got there. I think California was a great location for him, you know, much more generally welcoming to gay communities, gay kids. And I thought you just go to school and you figure out what you are. And then you come home and tell mom and dad when you get good and ready. And when he told me about it, well, it was just such a great conversation. I know he felt good about it. He told me he did. He was just so relieved. And it went something like this. He said, I have something to tell you. He said, I'm gay. And I said, are you okay with it? And he said, I'm okay with it. And I said, great, that's all I need. And then we started talking about all these gay clubs that he went to and the gay pride parade. And oh my gosh, we just had a blast talking about it because I said, what are they like, Pat? You know, these are all of his friends in Germany. He said, they're the best people in the world. And I said, oh my gosh. It was just such great news. It just was so helpful. Anyway, yeah, we had a lot of a good time, you know, before the end.
Can you imagine if you weren't there for him all those years? Just think, you keep looking back on all of these lovely conversations, and they had to have been so special for him as well. Just to have a loving mother who was welcoming and willing to listen and learn and embrace what he loved.
Yeah,
you can't ask for more than that. You can't do more than that.
Well, the problem is that you judge yourself by the consequences.
Yes,
you know, you judge yourself by the outcome.
Yeah.
So everything you thought you were doing right, which, okay, it felt right in the moment, and then all of a sudden it's completely eliminated. All of a sudden, everything right becomes everything wrong. Everything. Your confidence is shot. So that was the wonderful gift from you, Pat. Really, I have to say. The wonderful gift from you was that you restored some of that confidence. The first prize in the LGBTQ category was, oh my gosh. It meant so, so much, I can't tell you, because it was a gift to Pat. You know, it was a recognition of who he was. He just would have been so pleased. And his twin sister, my daughter Libby, is also gay. So it's a thrill for her, for me, to give that credibility to what his identity was. It was just such a proud moment. So, and then the other ones were fabulous as well, because as I was saying, you know, after suicide, you know, your confidence, your credibility is just shot to pieces. It's gone. And you gave that back.
Oh my gosh. You are warming my heart. Thank you. Thank you for saying that, because I wouldn't know that otherwise. It's a blessing for me to meet somebody like yourself who is just so vulnerable and honest and cares to, you didn't have to write this book, but maybe you did, but I'm saying you really didn't. Maybe you did. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. No, you're right. I didn't have to write it. And I thought, well, he chose to die. And I said to myself, I'm sorry. I'm not going to let that happen completely. I am going to make you come alive somehow, in some form, and this is how I'm going to do it. And to tell you the truth, I hated writing it. I had to confront everything that I did wrong. I had to be honest with him, with myself, my ignorance about depression, about being gay, how hard that was. But if I was going to do it, I was going to do it right. And that's what you gave me. You gave me that confirmation. So yeah, you're right. I didn't have to write it, but I just wasn't, I couldn't let him die. I felt like I let him die one time and I just wasn't going to do it again.
Right. And you know, something you will never know is how this book may change the lives of others. Most people will not reach out to you after they read it, but you have no idea what impact it's going to make on other people. So just putting that out there almost anonymously and not always getting feedback and not maybe not getting positive feedback that you would so desire doesn't mean that it's not out there helping people. So yeah, you just gave the world a gift through him.
I hope so.
Yes, I do believe so.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, you are such a special human. This is way beyond a conversation that I expected. Thank you for having this with me. I want to make sure as we begin to wrap up, though, we're not missing anything. Was there something additional or anything that you wanted to highlight?
I guess my initial reason is just what you talked about, that it could help other people, because most of the suicide memoirs I read talked about what happened, but not why. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that I went beyond the what happened into the why part so that people could learn, people could take away information that might help them. How depression operates, how difficult it is to come out to your parents, how much more that I learned to understand, which I thought I understood while he was talking to me about it, but how much I learned that I had to be really more where he needed me to be, which was helping him get help. So I guess that's my main thing, is that I tried to go beyond most suicide memoirs, talk about the difficulties that LGBTQ people face. And if people can come away with that information, I'll be so happy if that happens. Thanks to you. I hope it will.
Well, I'm sure it already has. As I said to you, you may not know about the depth and the breadth of it, because many times people just don't reach out to an author to say, hey, this helped me. But it just a turn of a word or something you might have said or a phrase in that book can alter somebody's entire trajectory. And I do believe that with all my heart. I really, really do.
Yeah, I hope you're right.
I hope that for you as well. So what's next? Are you going to continue via other books or speaking events? What's on your thought process with this?
Well, I've done well with reviews. With I had a really interesting presentation at the Putnam Library, which was not only about the book but how Pat's story illustrates the stages of suicide. For example, I went into a researcher that I really come to admire called Thomas Joyner, whose father killed himself probably not long before Patrick, actually. You know, an incredible family. Father was very successful, businessman, had done well financially with his investments, and then retired from his profession, and then got up one morning, walked out of the house before his family members were awake, and drove a little bit a ways and stabbed himself to death. So at the time, Thomas Joyner was a graduate student, and he decided to concentrate on the topic of suicide. And he came out with a theory, the interpersonal theory of suicide, which I think adds a lot of clarity to the subject. And so I gave a presentation on that just a few days ago. And it was, people were wonderful and quiet and, you know, seemed to take it in. But the best part was that after it was done and I asked for questions, at first I didn't get any. And then somebody opened up a question. And then all of a sudden we were there for another hour with people's stories about suicide. And I thought this was such a gift that they finally felt like there was a place where they could talk about it, you know, their own experiences. And it just made me feel like this is what we all needed.
Mm-hmm. So powerful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is powerful. It really right. is.
And to be the catalyst for that. I love that, how you probably stood there for a couple of moments and nobody raised their hands and you're thinking, hello. Yeah. And all it took was that first person. And that, I don't think anyone probably would have been in that presentation had they not had a reason to.
Yeah.
So you knew they all had hidden stories that were just
afraid
to bring them out. And just that, think of that. That maybe for the very first time, somebody might have raised their hand and spoke the words where maybe they had never done that before. And your presentation gave them that moment, that outlet to do so. And now they're free to continue that ability to speak up and speak out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right. It was the best part of the whole evening. So it's amazing how... I've found this audience. It's like I'm the recording secretary of the worst club in the entire world.
Exactly.
You know, a place where nobody wants to be. But I love being known as Patrick's mom. That's how I introduce myself. And I've written a couple of op-eds on suicide for the Hartford Courant. And I think it's because it's just something, it's something that people share. And when you can add to that conversation, they are open to it. It's really helpful.
Right. The title, obviously a lot of thought went into that title, Back from Suicide, Before and After the Essential Patrick. How did you come to put those words together?
Oh, that took a long haul, but anyway, the book is mostly about coming back from suicide. It's how I did it, which I hope is maybe a roadmap for a few other people. And Patrick was known as the Essential Patrick by his best friends in Berlin because he was just such a charming, loving, humble person. And so to them, he was essential.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went back to some of the remarks that they made at his memorial at the Stanford Center in Berlin, and then here in Pomfret, Connecticut, and then again out at Stanford and Palo Alto. And it just seemed like he wasn't just Patrick. He was the essential Patrick. And the back from suicide part, you know, as my husband said, he said, you know, what you're emphasizing is that you can do it. You can come back from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that take on it.
I do too. And I especially love the essential Patrick. That is such, that makes you smile, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it really does. Oh, Marie, you are amazing. All right. Well, if you would then give us contact information where folks can find out more about you and get copies of this extremely important book.
Oh, thanks. Well, there's a website, which is www.backfromsuicide.com. And there's a link to the book for sale on Amazon. There will be an audio book coming out soon. In order to write well, I read the book out loud, I don't know, gosh, too many times. But anyway, so it should read well as an audio book if I'm working on a narrator. And my email is backfromsuicide@gmail.com.
All righty, backfromsuicide.com. Marie, thank you for sharing Patrick's story in your book, Back from Suicide. I just want to say that your courage and determination to turn tragedy into understanding gives us insight and compassion. And by sharing his experience, we honor his life and also learn how to better support those struggling with depression. I am so grateful for your voice and your willingness to help others through this story. You're a gift. Thank you so much for sharing your book with us and for this conversation today.
Thank you, Pat. I'm deeply grateful. Thank you.